We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. My name is Rita Schulte, and I'm sitting in for David Inge this morning on the second hour of Focus 580. Our guest this morning is Dr. Suzanne Troopin, obstetrician-gynecologist with the Women's Health Practice here in the Champaign-Urbana area. And welcome this morning. Good morning. We'd like to invite your calls this morning. If you have questions or concerns, any area of a woman's life health is subject of good subject for this morning's conversation. We'd like to remind you, though, that Dr. Troopin cannot diagnose if she cannot see you, and she cannot see you. The number to call is 217. It's 222-9455 here in the studio. Good. Welcome.
Thank you.
And you have a number of
I do. I come every other month now, so I try to accumulate a few things to talk about.
Excellent. And what's on top of mind this week?
Well, I've been involved in clinical trials for about 20, 25 years now, and we're always interested in improving oral contraceptive pills, as the efficacy has been well known to be in even inconsistent use to be very, very effective, and we're still in a hunt to improve side effects and minor annoyances for every pill user out there. Mm-hmm. So we have a new pill study enrolling, and this is going to evaluate the effectiveness and safety of an investigational 91-day oral contraceptive therapy. So it's one mm-hmm. of those pills that you have ideally, only 4 menstrual cycles per year, so less than a once-a-month menstrual withdrawal bleed, which is very pleasant for some people. Mm-hmm.
I had a question from a staff member just this morning as I was walking down the hall, and I was curious about this as well. How is this a good thing? Is this harmful in the long run? Is that what you're studying to see what the long-range side effects of just having a
fewer
period?
Menstrual mm-hmm. periods? Well, it's very different when a woman is not being given medication to control her periods versus someone who is not having menstrual periods at all. Mm-hmm. So someone who presents herself to her gynecologist and says, I am not having a menstrual period. Am I healthy? Well, she might have a medical problem. She might have a high estrogen state where she is not ovulating regularly, but her body is overproducing estrogen. That has consequences. Or she might be having a very low estrogen state where her body is not ovulating at all, but she has a very low estrogen state. And actually, both those conditions might manifest as lack of periods. Of course, she could be pregnant. You know, yeah. We always roll that one right out to begin with. But when you're on a oral contraceptive pill, that pill probably has some estrogen and some progesterone, and it has it in a quantity such that the lining tissue stays very, very thin. And so there's really nothing to shed on a regular basis. So you have enough hormone to maintain a healthy status in your body, but not enough hormone to thicken up that lining so that you don't need actually a withdrawal bleed, and mm-hmm. the uterus stays quite healthy. And actually, you can maximize the benefits of the birth control pill and what we call our non-contraceptive benefits. Mm-hmm. And that is why we are looking into this pill. And one thing that is special about our particular research study is that we're also recruiting patients regardless of what we call their BMI, their height per weight. Mm-hmm. And not all research trials have recruited patients regardless of their weight. And mm-hmm. we think that it's very important to study patients who are of different weight categories.
Mm-hmm. Who makes, if someone was interested in participating in a study, what sort of profile should they be fitting into? Is there a specific age group? Is there?
Well, good question. Every study has what we call inclusion and exclusion mm-hmm. criteria. And so when a patient is interested in a research trial, we like them to contact us at Women's Health Practice, and We occasionally even have studies for men. We're working on a chlamydia vaccine. So right now, if there's a male who's been exposed to chlamydia, he could call and we could draw his blood. But that's a little sidetrack. But yes, we have trials that enroll for many different women's health indications, many different age groups. But each trial has its specific inclusion and exclusion criteria. So if a patient calls, we'll probably ask her a few specific questions about what she might be interested in and if she fits a particular criteria for any of our currently enrolling trials, then we might recruit her. For instance, right now we are specifically studying ovulation induction in infertility patients who don't have menstrual cycles. So someone who doesn't have periods but is interested in getting pregnant might fit the criteria for one study, but someone who has some menstrual cycle irregularities but wants to contracept might be a different group of patients. And if we don't have a trial that's currently enrolling but might be in the future, we might put that individual in our research data bank for a future phone call.
Okay. I want to remind everybody that we do have two telephone numbers you can call if you have questions you'd like to ask our guest, Dr. Suzanne Troopin, this morning. 217-333-9455 if you're local. And if you are out of our area code or out of the area altogether, you might want to consider calling 800-222-9455. If you're listening online, 800-222-9455 would be a great number for you to call right now. There are other studies that you were talking about. There's new studies on hormone replacement at the other end of a woman's life where she's hit menopause or getting ready to hit menopause, and there's all of those issues associated with our hormone balance and your body's health.
Well, yes, absolutely. A few new trials that have come out are looking at the different kinds of compounds. I've talked in the past about compounds called SERMs, S-E-R-M-S, selective estrogen receptor modulators. And as we move along in time, we decide to use different kinds of terminology. And actually, the FDA is encouraging us to get away from that term SERMs. And we're hoping that that term will pass from terminology. We'll see. It's been applied for many years. But we're now trying to talk about agonist and antagonist action, which is easier for the physicians to understand and the healthcare providers, I think, than the patients. But there are compounds that can positively affect estrogen receptors and compounds that antagonize those estrogen receptors. So we are hoping that as time marches forward, that when we're treating certain conditions, we will be able to use molecules that aren't always purely hormones and therefore be able to get away from some of those compounds. There are still many conditions in women that have no current treatment, such as sexual dysfunction. And we haven't really found success at treating sexual dysfunction in women just purely with estrogen. The most promising compound that we've looked at to date has been testosterone. We're still enrolling one of our trials with testosterone and sexual dysfunction. But we're hoping that we will have other trials in the future with other types of compounds for people who have contraindications to hormone therapy.
Well, I know that a few years ago, right around 2001, 2002, there was a big scare rippled through the news very, very quickly, all the bad news about hormone replacement. Has there been any good news that didn't ripple back as fast?
Well, absolutely. Well, I know that I think that it was perceived by many people, patients, people in the media as bad news, but I think it was also perceived by physicians as good news. So, for instance, I think that we found that the hormone replacement therapy that we were prescribing was very safe. It just was less safe than we had calculated, but it actually was extraordinarily safe. So, for instance, if we talk about heart attacks, we found that with the use of hormone replacement therapy, even when started very late in the menopause, up to 10 to 15 years after menopause, if you looked at 10,000 women, we had a rate of about 37 heart attacks out of 10,000 women versus in the placebo group, 30. So if you said, well, we had 37 heart attacks versus 30 heart attacks, you would have to say, yes, this sounds like a much greater rate. And statistically, it was a greater rate, so that sounded like a problematic rate. But in fact, it was very safe. Mm-hmm. We also confirmed that it protected against bone fractures. We also confirmed that there were other benefits to the hormone therapy, but that as we look forward at that data, and they still publish from that trial, they found that women who started hormone replacement therapy that decade to decade and a half prior to menopause were able to reap many of the benefits, even the cardiovascular benefits, that seemed to elude the women that started it so late. Mm-hmm. So the answer really wasn't what is wrong with hormone therapy. The answer was really what is wrong with our patients. And that's our job, too, to improve our patients' health overall. And the answer is that it's one type of patient who presents to you in her late 40s, who is symptomatic in her early 50s, who may be symptomatic, versus the patient in her early 60s. And if you can combat those symptoms early on with one type of therapy, as you move later into the menopause, your best way of combating what are your most important issues aren't necessarily hormone therapy strategies, but other strategies aimed at improving heart health.
You sort of alluded to something. It was a question I was going to save to the end because you always need an end question, you know, when you interview somebody. And I thought this is the proper moment because we've talked about a couple of things. And when you made the comment about improving the patient, here's a question. We were in a restaurant the other day, and there was a young lady on the phone that was talking to her friend on a cell phone. And she was going over stuff that there's a better than even chance, if my physician friends are correct, she wouldn't even bring up with her doctor. If I'm going to be a good patient, and if I'm going to train my daughters to be good patients, when I go into my doctor's office, what are the kinds of things at all of the stages of our lives? Because they're in their 20s and 30s, and I'm now in my, I'm not going to say it on the air, I'm a lot older than that. What should I be teaching my daughter to talk to her physician about now? So when she, as she goes through life, when she reaches her 40s and her 50s and her 60s, she knows what to say, what kinds of things to help her physician guide the two of them through making sure she stays healthy as long as possible as she ages.
Okay. I would say that's the 40-part question you got going there.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
For our ending perfect question. All right. Well, you have a lot of good questions there, so we're going to assume she wasn't on the phone with her doctor sitting next to you. But I think
I can pretty much guarantee that.
Okay. So I'm teasing you a little bit there. Mm-hmm. But I think that if we start with our patients when they're young, it's ideal to have a first get acquainted visit. And ideally, you're going to get established with a healthcare provider that you know and knows you and understands you as an individual and your healthcare risks so that your daughter and my daughter and our friend's daughter and our cousin's daughter and
some
stranger's daughter. They may have very similar health care issues and needs, but they may have individual health care issues and needs. And definitely we partition individuals by age groups, and we have issues that we like to bring up in the teen years. We have issues in the 20s. We have issues in that sort of childbearing time. Then we have issues in that post-childbearing time. Then we get to the perimenopause, the menopausal time, and the postmenopause. And we try to focus our care and our discussions with our patients on those issues. By the same token, the patient could do some preparation in terms of what has gone on between those visits. So what are some new medicines? Have you had any health care provider visits in between? Have you had any other issues? Do you have any new symptoms? Are you planning a pregnancy? Are you planning to become newly sexually active, or are you changing partners, or has your partner changed partners? Those kinds of issues definitely impact the kind of care that you're going to get. And we definitely, when we see patients, we help them decide, and I think this is going to be important as healthcare changes, where we're going to focus our care. Getting that initial first pap smear that's usually indicated at age 21 or within 3 years of becoming sexually active is and has been shown over and over again to be cost beneficial. But now when I was growing up, the first pap smear, that age was 16. Mm-hmm. And we have moved that up to age 21. Mm-hmm. We recommend human papillomavirus testing as part of pap smear testing starting at age 30, because that is cost effective. But it is not necessarily cost effective to do that at a younger age. Now, as we are developing and working on newer tests, it may be cost effective to do that first HPV test younger, particularly in somebody who has been vaccinated versus somebody who has not. As our population gets widespread HPV vaccinations, then that individual may or may not need as many pap smears. So the type of care that individual has gotten will then direct the kind of care that she gets. And same with the kind of genetics you have. We have Breast Cancer Awareness Month coming up next month, and we know that individuals who are testing positive for breast cancer genes, we recommend that they get MRIs rather than mammograms, because that is going to be safer for them. Mm-hmm. And we recommend, for instance, somebody who has had breast cancer in their family, that they start mammograms 10 years before their family member has had breast cancer. So a lot depends on your family history.
Mm-hmm. So if the perfect Dr. Coat, my one friend said, would say on the front, "Don't make me guess, talk to me." Because a lot of times he says, I know somebody is looking at me and they want me to figure it out without them having to talk to me. And, you know, I always thought that's why I sort of asked the question, and the answer was great. It was really helpful to know that honesty up front, lots of information back and forth probably can save your life and maybe can save you some healthcare cost along the way if we are frank with our physicians and tell them what, you know, ask the questions we have on our mind. Don't make them guess. Yes. Don't make me guess.
Well, I think that it is important to express your concerns. And I think that it is important to talk about what your concerns are. But very often, the patient does know what the most important symptoms are. But sometimes something subtle may not be what the patient understands to tell her healthcare provider about. Mm-hmm. So I guess now and then it is important for us to guess.
Yeah. You mentioned Breast Cancer Awareness Month is coming up. That's the 1st of October, right? It's the October
Correct.
Month of October.
Correct.
How are we making good progress on breast cancer awareness? Are people getting, are they taking advantage of some of the screening out there that is available? Or are we still hanging back as a patient group? Are we doing our part of that? And on the flip side, is there progress being made in the treatment of this disease, the long-term positive, good quality of life in between diagnosis?
Well, it's a good question, and since it's a call-in show, maybe our listeners should tell us whether mm-hmm. or not they're taking part in mammography and screenings and seeing their healthcare providers and mm-hmm. and getting those tests done. Their brand new tests like the Halo Breast Pap test, which I introduced into Illinois a couple of years ago. So there are many new screening tests that are available. I think that in the United States, we've seen a flattening of breast cancer mortality improvement. We do very well in terms of success rates of cure when we make that diagnosis, but we're still seeing the rates of breast cancer creeping up. And that is due to a lot of different reasons. The biggest risk factor for getting breast cancer is aging. Mm-hmm. And we do a good job of aging our population. So that's a good thing.
Yeah.
And when we make that early diagnosis of breast cancer on a mammogram, it's very likely that you're going to outlive that breast cancer. On the other hand, we don't have a lot of strategies in front of us that is truly prevention-oriented. We have seen with slightly less use of hormone replacement therapy and the use of lower dosages of hormone replacement therapy, we have seen a decrease. We saw a little bump in decrease in the rates of diagnosis of breast cancer in the early 2001, 2002, 2003 years. And then there was one study that said that not as many people were getting mammograms. Mammograms can still be very, very costly. Mm-hmm. It should be a relatively affordable test, but there's still a lot of hoops to jump through. Some insurance companies require that you really read the fine print very carefully and get pre-authorization. I've had a few patients of mine caught in that dilemma where they called up a mammographic place to get their testing, and they asked the place, "Oh, are you on my health care insurance?" And they were told yes. They went and got their test, but it turned out they hadn't contacted their insurance company for pre-authorization, and they were stuck for quite large sums of out-of-pocket costs, which should be, you know, a basic health care provider requirement of every insurance company. So it can be very, very tricky. We are lucky in our county alone. We are very progressive about participating in the Illinois Breast and Cervical Cancer Prevention Program, and that offers women who do not have health insurance or do not have public assistance to afford mammograms. They offer mammograms and pap smear testing, and you can go to the public health department and they will evaluate you to see if you can participate in this program. And I believe they told me that they had picked up 13 breast cancers last year through this program. So we're lucky in Champaign. Mm-hmm. I think that with this program, we do reach out to many women.
Mm-hmm. So that's 13 lives saved. Or
hopefully,
yeah. So I would say that that's probably something that everybody should be aware of if they're having some difficulty or they think they're having difficulty getting some help, to be on the lookout for some of those things. One of the other elements that you talked about in connection with hormone replacement therapy was bone density. And I know that when I go to my physician's office, they offer me there's an array of things that I can do for to help my bone density, make sure that I don't break anything. I'm a little hard on the equipment, but they're worried that I'm making sure that I'm healthy, have good bone health. And that's not just a woman's problem. That's also a man's problem. And I've read a lot in the press, always a good place for medical advice, but vitamin D, as well as some of the bisphosphates and some of the other things, people are hearing more about vitamin D as something that we should be keeping an eye on, making sure we have enough of that in our diet to maintain health.
Well, vitamin D is a very important vitamin. It does many things for our health, and it has many benefits beyond just bone health. But we have radically increased the amount of vitamin D that we recommend women of menopausal age get. So we used to say that 400 a day would be a satisfactory amount, and many guidelines now say in the range of 800 to 1,000 international units per day of vitamin D is very important. We tend to recommend that women use the natural form of vitamin D. We think that vitamin D3 is a little bit better than D2, but it's hard to get products that actually select out that. But if you're getting in the range of 800 to 1,000 units of vitamin D a day, you're doing your bones a lot of good. And it's hard to know that your vitamin D blood level is appropriate without actually getting tested. And again, they've changed the guidelines quite a bit. I think I've talked about this before, that about 5 or 6 years ago, one of my osteoporosis studies was requiring vitamin D blood levels. And it was one of the earlier studies that we were looking at vitamin D levels. And I thought to myself, oh, none of my patients will have any problems getting into the research study based on their vitamin D level. And I think we probably had about 20% of our patients excluded based on their vitamin D level. And actually, we were using a much lower vitamin D level cutoff than they use today. So it probably would have been closer to 30%, and for a variety of reasons. And so if you haven't ever had your vitamin D level checked, might be something to discuss with your healthcare provider. Mm-hmm. But they have done some studies that show that if you get a proper amount of exercise, you take in calcium, you use vitamin D, you have bones that aren't really in a truly osteoporotic range, and you really need to get tested to determine that. But at any rate, they have shown in some smaller studies even a 50% fracture reduction rate just from taking in that adequate amount of calcium, mm-hmm. vitamin D with exercise.
Mm-hmm. And are we getting less vitamin D because we're not outside so much? Is our food not? I mean, it's not a vitamin that you just naturally get from food. You have to be supplemented.
You get it from sun. Mm-hmm. You make it in your skin. So definitely living in the north, you're not exposed mm-hmm. to sun as much. We tend to wear clothes when it's chilly outside.
Yeah.
We definitely do wear more sunscreen because of our risk of skin cancers. So that is something. But we lose some of the ability to convert through our skin. Through sun exposure, the vitamin D as our skin ages.
Oh, that's not fair.
It doesn't do it quite as effectively, mm-hmm. but vitamin D is necessary for that calcium to move from the dietary sources into our bloodstream. Mm-hmm. So it's important to have that vitamin D in order to get the benefit from the dietary calcium. Mm-hmm. So they go hand in hand.
Is there, this may not be a question, might be for a dietitian, but I bet that you have at least a thought on it. If I wanted to increase and improve the absorption of the calcium and the vitamin D, am I better off taking something that I get off the rack, that off the shelf, that's a combination, taking them separately? How do I keep my stomach from not being happy with me and all of that?
There are studies that do show variability in the amount of absorption of calcium. Calcium probably is best absorbed with food. You're less likely to get the side effects of calcium, such as constipation, if you actually do take it fairly close to a meal. But most of us are going to, whatever system we come up with for getting our D and our calcium in, most of us are going to do just fine mm-hmm. with whatever we do. Okay. And I usually tell my patients to think about their pocketbook and go in expensive. Mm-hmm. And the forms of Tums and Rolaids, those things that are pure calcium carbonate, and very often many of them are supplemented with D, those are absolutely fine. Mm-hmm. I tend to chew the chocolates, but...
There you go.
Yeah. Everybody has their things they like.
Everything tastes better if you think it tastes like chocolate. I'm with you on that one. I'd like to remind our audience today that you can call in with a question or a concern. Our phone numbers are 217-333-9455. If you're out of the area code, 800-222-9455. Our guest this morning is Dr. Suzanne Troupin. She's an obstetrician and gynecologist with the Women's Health Practice here in Champaign-Urbana-Savoy. And you were talking a little bit earlier about there were some more hormone replacement tests or hormone therapy tests. Have we covered that?
Well, when we talk about doing our bone density, mm-hmm. many people are aware that they have gotten a DEXA scan. But most individuals that have gotten a DEXA scan, I find that means that they've only gotten tested in their spine and their hip, mm-hmm. But with the traditional views. And very few individuals have gotten what's called a vertebral fracture analysis. And if you've ever taken a look at your bone density test, which not very many people have actually seen the pictures of the studies, but most of those are shot straight on. So if you had the test done, you were probably laying on your back when you had the test done. And the vertebral fracture analysis, you're lying on your side. Mm-hmm. So we're actually physically looking for wedge fractures of the spine. And when we get those wedge fractures, we get what are called osteoporotic compression fractures. And so somebody who has a compression fracture of the vertebral spine, they might have a bone density reading of the spine that actually looks normal or even high normal. And what's an error is that actually they've had that compression, so there's extra calcium within that vertebral body space that the machine is reading, but because it's compressed down.
Oh, I see.
So it's actually a fracture. So unless you get that vertebral fracture analysis, sometimes you might have a false sense of security. Mm-hmm. And there have been some new guidelines instituted about who actually needs medication therapy. Mm-hmm. And these new guidelines were put forth by the World Health Organization. So many physicians were going by the strict guidelines of the bone density. So mm-hmm. they would look at your number, and based on that number, they would pretty much recommend therapy without a whole lot else into the formula. And some of us then moved from looking at that number relative to your age. Mm-hmm. So for instance, if you had the identical number at 45 to somebody who was 75, that 75-year-old is actually 30% as likely to have a fracture as that 45-year-old, even with the same number that might not be a very good number, just because mm-hmm. there are other factors.
Right.
Because whether you fracture or not has to do with the strength of your bone. Mm-hmm. And the thickness only probably represents about 25% of your bone strength. And that other 25% probably has to do with the quality of the bone. That's not really being monitored by the pure taking of that mm-hmm. thickness measurement. So the World Health Organization wanted to change that, and they have come up with a FRAX score. Mm-hmm. And you can calculate your own FRAX score by at least roughly if you don't know your bone density measurements, but you can go on the National Osteoporosis Foundation website, or you can just Google FRAX, it's FRAX capitals, and you put in your ethnicity, your age, your height, your weight, and you can calculate your own FRAX score. And based on that, they give you a 10-year prediction as to how likely you are to have a hip fracture or any osteoporotic mm-hmm. fracture. Based on that, actually, there are fewer people that probably need treatment.
Okay. We have a phone call on line number one from Mattoon. Hello.
Hi. Am I on?
Yes.
Yes. I just wondered, how many minutes of sun a day?
Well,
vitamin D.
Well, you know, they used to say that if you at least got 15 or 20 minutes of sun, but that varies depending on the season, depending on your age, and depending on your health and your genetic background. So theoretically, all of us have about the same number of melanocytes in our skin, just as how many of those are sort of turned on and able to respond. So it really varies. But if you're somebody that for some reason is having medical issues with your bone, with your calcium level, with your levels of fatigue or other medical problems that would indicate that you might have abnormal D levels or can't be out in the sun at all, it's a simple blood test to measure what your vitamin D level is.
Okay, my dog walks me twice a day, so I thought I might be able to get it in that way.
You might, but if you're using sunscreen on your face,
no,
which you should be.
I know, but then I
and gloves and a coat, there might not be a whole lot of exposed area there.
Okay, all right, thank you.
Thank you for your call this morning. Our number again is 217-333-9455. If you're out of the area code, 800-222-9455. And we're speaking this morning with Dr. Suzanne Troopin, who is with the Women's Health Practice, Obstetrics and Gynecology Practice here in the Champaign-Urbana-Savoy area. And we invite your phone calls about anything that you might have a question about regarding women's health, or if you have some concerns that you would like to address or some definitions you'd like maybe the doctor to help you understand a little bit better. The number again, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. We were talking about bone health and bone strength. It's not just a women's issue at all.
No, it's not, but it's more of a young woman's mm-hmm. issue, and statistically, it's mm-hmm. more of a women's issue than a man's issue. Mm-hmm. Women have smaller bones. Mm-hmm. Smaller bones are always more at risk than larger bones, and women's balance is a little bit worse, mm-hmm. so you're more likely to have a fall. And falls are statistically correlated with more fractures, particularly osteoporotic fractures. The basic guideline, if you had absolutely no risk factors, would be to have a bone density by age 65 if you're a female and 70 if you're a male.
Mm-hmm. And basically, that's a non-invasive test. You lay down and they make a scan, pretty much.
You do, but you have guidelines as to mm-hmm. a weight limit. About 275 pounds is the weight limit for mm-hmm. lying down on the tables. Otherwise, we can use wrist measurements, mm-hmm. and anybody could get a wrist fracture analysis.
Mm-hmm. And that will give you a good estimation of your...
Pretty good fracture prediction, not mm-hmm. as accurate in terms of fracture prediction. The inner region of the hip is probably our best fracture prediction region, mm-hmm. According to the International Society of Clinical Densitometry, of which I've been a member and certified with, but pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Another question that was not through the phones, but through the hallway questions, you get these as you come down the hallway birth control pills that restrict, there's an awful lot of mythology surrounding the menstrual period, the things that it does and the things that it affects, and probably some decent information involved in that. But if we are using hormone-based contraception, does that affect bone density at all, particularly the ones that are not cyclical? They run longer times before there's a period.
Well, if you're using a birth control pill that has estrogen, it should have a positive bone effect.
Positive bone effect. So
yes.
So it's not a negative bone effect. That was a question somebody had asked just, you know, randomly. And I'm like, okay, I'll slip it in there. Seems like a reasonable question to
ask.
And there's the problem with getting past a certain age. That brain cell just got a gray hair, and the question went with it. So we'll just move on to something else. We have a phone call on line number two right here on campus. Line two, hello.
Yeah, hi. I had two questions.
Okay.
One thing about, please address something regarding the omega-3 or the fish oil thing. And up to what age one gets the hot flashes? And I'll close the phone and listen. Thank you.
Okay. Well, in terms of hot flashes, they've done research studies to show that the most frequent age of hot flashes are those 2 to 4 years surrounding pre and post menopause, which the official definition of menopause is that one full year with no menstrual period. And the average age is 51.4. And it's pretty universal across all cultures, around the world and all ethnicities, so late 40s, early 50s. But when we do population-based studies, we find that about 2% of the population will still be having hot flashes into their 80s. So there are some patients that will have hot flashes very, very long. Now, definitely the frequency will space out for virtually everyone, but that's what you expect. And the current recommendation is to treat hot flashes if they are moderate or severe. So the FDA gives us a definition of this, and we say 7 or more per day or 50 or more per week. And when we enroll our clinical trials, that's kind of that's what we're looking for, that amount. And when you talk about relief, most compounds, for instance, the non-estrogen compounds, there was just a newer study published looking at some of the antidepressants and some of the other compounds that are used to treat hot flashes other than hormones. And you should see some significant improvement in about 4 weeks. So if you're trying something over the counter and you really haven't seen any significant improvement over 4 weeks' time, it's probably time to talk to your healthcare provider and see if there would be something else that you should do. In terms of omega-3, these are essential fats that we need for good health. They're important for many aspects of our health, heart health, brain health. They seem to prevent cancer. I talk to my young patients with abnormal pap smears on them because they've been associated with a reduced rate of frequency of perseverance of abnormal paps. So they really have tremendous amount of benefit in prenatal patients. They have been shown to have many benefits for the developing fetus, including brain benefits, eye benefits, prevention of preterm labor, other benefits in terms of the fetus itself, as well as the continued benefits for mom. There's been a little bit of flap in the media about where this omega-3 should come from. Should it be a synthetic source or an actual fish source? And they have shown that some of the fish oil sources of omega-3 probably contain those minute amounts of mercury that we worry about if we have too many fish portions. So some people have leaned towards synthetic versions of omega-3s or the plant versions of omega-3s like you can get in flaxseed. So you can read labels. There's a lot of good information on the internet. I usually steer patients to sites like WebMD or eMedicine or Medscape, Scientific American, but the big health conglomerates, the Harvard, Mayo's, those kinds of things, they have excellent health news as well that can help you sort through that information. I mean, even the big news sources, Google and Reuters, those things have a lot of good information.
We got an internet call, or somebody called and left a message. She was interested, he or she, on the latest testing for ovarian cancer.
Well, they just approved a new test for ovarian cancer, and it did get a lot of press. It hasn't really hit the clinical arenas yet. When the FDA approves the test, it takes a little while before it even quite makes it to the labs, and then it takes a little while until insurance companies pick it up. So I tend not to pay as much attention to it. Basically, we're looking for that perfect way to screen for ovarian cancer. We should back up and say that if all women use birth control pills or oral contraceptive pills for at least 20 years, we'd probably prevent about 80% of ovarian cancer. Of course, you could just be pregnant that whole time, too. That works. Suppression of ovulation is what we think is the key feature to prevention of ovarian cancer. But one of the problems with diagnosis of ovarian cancer is that since our ovaries are very small structures and in the larger area of our abdominal cavity, it's very hard to diagnose early ovarian cancer. So in patients who are high risk, we have done pelvic examinations, pelvic ultrasounds, and the blood test CA125, which is which is elevated in certain cases of what we call epithelial, so surface ovarian cancers. And about a year or two ago, they came out with a overture, I believe it was called, some name like that. I may have the name slightly wrong. But it was a five-part blood test, and actually CA125 was one of the five parts. And it was approved by the FDA also. I did use it in a few patients, but very quickly a couple of the organizations that treat gynecologic cancers came out against it because it had such a high false positive, false negative rate, and they felt that it was too experimental to really be of benefit to an average low-risk patient. So I think that's what we're waiting to see on this new test, whether this is going to be another test that is recommended for the high-risk patient or the low-risk patient. One of the problems of doing CA125s and ultrasounds on all low-risk patients is we'd have to take out about 350 sets of ovaries to find one ovarian cancer. So, you know, pretty much most of us feel that that's unreasonable. And so we need to get lots better predicting before we go running around doing that, and lots of women losing their ovaries and the benefits their ovaries can give them to prevent cancers. And taking out ovaries does not prevent all cases of ovarian cancer anyway. A small percentage of ovarian cancer cases, about 2-3%, occur in women who've had their ovaries removed. So it's not even 100% prevention. But knowing that you're a BRCA 1 or 2 patient, a breast cancer type 1 or 2 patient, those patients, some of them should, in fact, have ovarian removal. And I've already seen Myriad Genetics advertising that blood test. And if you think that you need that blood test, you should definitely come talk to one of us as your healthcare provider about whether you can get that test.
Okay. We've got about 4 minutes left in this hour of Focus 580. Did we cover your list?
Well, my list could go on for quite some time. I think we were going to talk about some other new initials that we might see on the horizon, and that's HPRT. I know we used to call hormone replacement therapy HRT, and actually if we do remove ovaries from a woman who's prior to the age of menopause, we still do use the nickname HRT. If we give her either estrogen and progesterone or estrogen therapy. But if we give hormone therapy after the age of natural menopause, the FDA has encouraged us to drop that R out of there and not call it replacement therapy, because they wouldn't naturally have any estrogen, progesterone circulating. Well, A group of researchers has now come up with a new treatment for vaginal dryness using dihydroepiandrosterone. And they have shown that that compound is converted to estrogen by the vaginal cells. So they have nicknamed this HPRT. And those initials stand for hormone precursor replacement therapy. And their theory is that this is going to be a novel but better way of giving estrogen treatment vaginally, because that allows the cells to take up this compound, convert it to estrogen, which allows them to then react to that estrogen in a positive way to treat the vaginal symptoms that the woman is having. But because there is no estrogen being presented to the vagina, there's no estrogen that is getting taken up by the bloodstream. So it really does not affect the blood level of estrogen in near the way that vaginal estrogen does. And we're learning more and more that vaginal estrogen can affect the blood level of estrogen. So something quite new there to talk about with your healthcare provider.
Now, and is this available?
It would have to be compounded, I would think.
Okay. So this is something that you would have to...
It'll hopefully be on the horizon, but just a little something new.
A little something out there.
Yeah.
Always something new. That's
always
good. And we've got about 30 seconds. Is there another?
And, well, like I think you and I were talking just before we went on the air about Gardasil, and that is the HPV vaccine. And I get a lot of questions about when it's going to be available for ages 26 to 45. I am a strong believer in the Gardasil vaccine, having been a researcher for those clinical trials, and I'd be happy to talk to any patients about it. It has been shown to be protective for that group of patients, but the FDA is still looking at that information, and it is not yet approved for that group of patients yet.
Great. It sounds like there's some interesting things coming up to keep us all healthy and happy longer and longer.
Yes.
Absolutely. I'm so very pleased to have had you here today as our guest. I want to thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
This has been Focus 580. My name is Rita Schulte. I've been sitting in for David Inch, who is off on a much-deserved vacation. This has been our hour with Dr. Suzanne Troopin with the Women's Health Practice. You can contact her. She's available online, womenshealthpractice.com.
Yes.
I'd like to thank you for listening this morning and to encourage you to stay tuned for many other programs that you will probably have an opportunity to enjoy today on AM 580, and tune in tomorrow when Focus 580 opens up at 10 o'clock. There's always an interesting topic of conversation. We hope you will enjoy the programs here. Today, this has been Focus 580 for today. We'd like to thank you for listening to our 2 hours and to stay tuned for the afternoon magazine. My name is Rita Schulte again, and we'd like to thank you for calling in and for listening this morning.